Hi everyone! I'm not going to say happy Monday because this episode is a few days late in going up. And so thank you so much for your patience and thanks for tuning in today. Today we're going to be talking about the C word. Cancer, not coronavirus. Cancer is something that is a concern to many, many, many people around the world. And my guest today is Dr. Prachi Bhave, who's an oncologist. At the time of recording this episode, Dr. Prachi was practicing in Melbourne, but she has now moved to Sydney and she works there as an oncologist. Dr. Prachi and I talk about what causes cancer, what doesn't cause it, who gets it, how to feel about having cancer, what to do when you've got a diagnosis, and how to avoid misinformation or how to stay clear of snake oil cures. And towards the end of this episode, you'll hear me getting emotional as we talk about death. It was a very cathartic experience talking about death with somebody who sees it every day up close as part of her job. And I felt really comforted to have my friend there and get such a good, sorted, and valuable perspective on how to think about death. I just want to make a note that in the first half of this episode, I talk a lot about obesity and the link between obesity and cancer. And say things like, just exercise more, or just always aim to move more. But this episode was recorded a few months ago, and since then, I've become a lot more aware about the problematic language of fat phobia, and even how it is used in the wellness or the health industries. And I realize that it's not as simple as saying exercise more, or just try and move more. We do address a little bit the many different issues that affect people's motivation to exercise, such as mental health or socioeconomic factors or education or access to healthy foods and exercise options, etc. But regardless of all that, I think now I wouldn't have said exercise more or try and move more. I think I would have used different language. So I'm a work in progress. My relationship with my body is a work in progress as a fat person. And so thank you for your patience as I grow. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you like it, if you want to take the discussion forward, connect with me on Instagram at HeckinConcernedPod, on Twitter at HeckinConcerned. There's also a Facebook page. I want to hear from you about what you liked, what you didn't like, what you want to hear more about next time. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I would like to acknowledge that this podcast is produced on Wurundjeri land.
This is Amrita, and you're listening to Heckin' Concerned Podcast. Heck, 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 Heckin' Concerned.
Dr. Prachi Bhave, welcome to Heckin' Concerned Podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So, you are one of my dearest friends, and you're a doctor and an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the coolest things about you is that you have been to NASA to study space medicine.
Yes, that's right. That's my claim to fame. I went, now 5 or 6 years ago, and yeah. I went for 3 months, right at the end of my medical school, and it was very cool.
Wow. And so you have to be an American to go there?
No, you could be a citizen from anywhere. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah,
yeah. It was out of this world.
And when you were at NASA, you studied the impact of space on astronauts' bodies.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't send humans anymore to space, do they?
They do, on the International Space Station.
Okay.
So we've always got actually at least 3 humans orbiting around the Earth.
Okay.
Generally, it's an American, a Russian, and someone from somewhere else.
Why do they do that kind of representation?
Well, the International Space Station, it's been formed by multiple countries, with America and Russia having the major contribution, but right. Canada, Japan, various other countries also have built it. So often every 6 months or so they rotate the astronauts and send three new people up and bring the 3 old people back down. So there's always someone out in space.
And when you were at NASA, you got a chance to speak with
with
I forget her name.
Now even mine.
Oh my god! How can we?
I know her name's Williams.
Sunita Williams.
Sunita Williams. That's right.
Oh my god! How can I forget? I'm so sorry, Sunita Williams. You're, you know, we admire you tremendously, and we also forgot your name.
And I know she's listening to this podcast.
Definitely, yeah. This Heckin' Concern podcast is streaming universally, even at the International Space Station.
Amazing. Yes. No, I did speak to Sunita Williams. That's right. Briefly, she was in space, and she was due for a conference with her doctor in Johnson Space Center to have a medical checkup. So they allowed us six medical students to quickly talk to her. Obviously, we didn't discuss anything medical, but she showed us a few cool tricks. She did a spin. Her hair was standing up on edge. She drank some water, which just turned into droplets, and she ate it.
Oh,
so that was very cool. Yeah.
I love seeing those space videos of them demonstrating how they do everyday tasks.
Exactly.
In space.
Exactly.
Do you think that sitting all the way up there on the International Space Station, these astronauts must be feeling so like blissfully out of all of the politics and the chaos going on Earth, right?
Absolutely. I think I can imagine it would probably be quite a humbling experience where you're in front of you, you're seeing Earth, and anyone and everything you've ever known is there out in front of you.
Yeah.
The good and the bad.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty peaceful, calm environment, I'd imagine, to be in.
Yeah.
And you don't have to focus on all the everyday crap.
But do they get the news up there? They must be.
They do, yeah, yeah. They pretty much have the internet there. So.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Duh. They have Facebook. No, but they must be feeling so sad. Like, here they can sit in space and look at this green orb, and that's their home planet.
Mm.
And then on the planet, all of the beings that are at the top of the food chain are fighting each other. There's
exactly
they're clearing away the green on the planet.
Yep.
Does it actually look green and blue?
Well, from the images I've seen.
Yeah.
And you can see where all the, like on top of rainforests, Amazon and things, you can see where all the condensation has developed.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You can see if a volcano is erupting. You can't see Trump's head, but you can see other
things. No, that's because it's too far up his own ass. So it's very dark there.
Yes.
But they must be feeling so sad. Like, I would feel sad. I don't know if I'm just hormonal today or what, but I would feel so sad, like, looking at that planet and going, oh man, my species is destroying
exactly right. And people, they probably, I mean, I imagine they think that the humans should be united and the whole humanitarian kind of aspect of life is gone, and now we're just fighting each other or bickering over small things, when really we are quite lucky to be alive, quite lucky to have this planet and focus on the big picture. But yeah.
I don't know, do you think Sunita Williams believes in aliens?
Yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of the astronauts probably think that there's life out there, but not in a true classic Hollywood, you know, alien form.
Yeah, yeah.
More like at a microscopic organism level.
Well, that's what we could see. From where we can see, they're most likely microscopic. But we don't really know, do we?
We don't. And I don't know that we'll really ever know. The universe is too big and our technology is too small to be able to explore everything.
Yeah.
So, but I think it's a fair estimate to say that there is something else out there, but probably not the six-fingered, two-headed aliens that we might be imagining.
No, where have you seen two-headed ones?
Oh.
So we've had like
the football head ones.
Head ones, or E.T. We've had the ones from Alien versus Predator.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
yeah, no,
you're an oncologist. Why are we talking about space?
Anyway.
No, but because you love space too, right?
Yeah, I do. I do. Yes.
Hey, so do astronauts have a different rate of cancer, or is there just such a small population that you can't really?
Well, there is a small population, so we can't really tell, and they haven't lived long enough for us to see if they develop cancer, but they certainly are exposed to more radiation than we are because they don't have the atmosphere to protect them up there.
Okay.
So they are directly exposed to the radiation, or more radiation from the sun as well as other things around them. So there is theory that they are exposed to much more radiation in the time they spend up there, but we have to watch them over the next few decades to see if they all or most of them get cancer.
And what about the older ones now that are really
I know, they haven't had a higher rate, but I think the numbers are too small. So
interesting. What else did you learn about the impact of space on the human body?
So let me think. So I learned about how when you go in space, there's less gravity. Mm-hmm. There's still gravity, but it's microgravity or minimal gravity, and that's why your hair stands up on end and all of that. But that also has an effect on the spine, because actually, if you think of human evolution, we are not really meant to be walking on two legs.
Mm.
But when we do walk on two legs, our spine is pulled down because of gravity.
Okay.
And so our height is shortened a little bit.
Oh.
But whereas when you're in space, your spine can elongate because mm-hmm. there's less gravity. So actually your height increases, and that can have a number of effects on back pain, the pressures in your head. So the pressure of fluid and around your brain, and that can sometimes cause headaches and visual problems. So that's something they're looking into. There's no real way around it because you can't do anything about the gravity. But when people come back down from space, they're back in an environment with gravity. So that can impact the spine again and the back pain.
Right.
And also the classic one is muscle deconditioning that happens when you're in space. Because you don't have gravity, your muscles and your bone density decrease quite rapidly. So the astronauts actually have to exercise about 2 to 2.5 hours every day.
Wow.
It's compulsory. So some even come back more fit than they were having gone up. I actually got to see the gym equipment that they exercise on, because it's quite interesting. You can imagine you can't really run on a treadmill in space because you can't stick to the treadmill. You float off.
Yeah.
So you have to wear a harness around your waist and essentially be tethered to the treadmill and exercise on it. And same thing in terms of lifting weights. There's no gravity, so there's no resistance. So you're not actually lifting weights.
Also, they have to have equipment that it needs to be tethered to stuff then that they pull or push.
Exactly.
In order to, it's a resistance-based program, because weights would be useless.
Exactly. So they use springs and they pull or push against a spring rather than lifting something up or down, which is how we typically do weights, because there's no gravity. So that's pretty cool. I thought a nice interesting engineering to develop all of that.
It's so fascinating how humans have figured out how to go into space and how to thrive. Not thrive, but how to survive there.
Yep, absolutely.
Wow, amazing.
I think it's very cool.
So do you think we know more about space than we know about cancer?
Probably not.
Okay.
I think we know very little about space, actually.
Okay. All right.
I think we know far more about medicine or biology or human biology in general.
Yeah.
I think space science is still in its infancy and it's got a very long way to go.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'm just amazed at our species' ability to know things. Like how we know our bodies so well and how we know, just how we've problem solved our way and evolved in this way is just amazing.
And I think our awareness of who we are, or the fact that we're an unusual species and that we have probably higher intelligence, arguably, than a lot of other or everything else on the planet. Being able to think about that and then say, hey, is there something else out there, or can we leave this planet?
Yeah.
I think that's very cool.
Yeah. Our intelligence suits our needs very well. And one of the things that we have better over other species is our ability to unite and work as a team. And there's this philosophy by this writer, Yuval Noah Harari, that our strength is actually in our imaginations, that we could collectively believe in a cause or a myth. For example, say freedom of humans is a myth, or goodness or kindness is a myth, then we collectively believe in that and we agree to collaborate and cooperate with each other towards that imaginary, arbitrarily set goal that's important to us. So our ability to imagine and organize ourselves in numbers is apparently our greatest strength. And that's exactly, like, that's how medicine works as well. We all agree that, for example, we all agree that we need to eradicate cancer. Maybe, obviously in the old days people succumbed to it, but now we've come to this understanding that this is a world where it's not acceptable for us to live with cancer. Sometimes I think about how interesting and funny it is that we've come to believe that it's our right not to suffer from diseases anymore, because we have the ability to
absolutely.
I shouldn't have to suffer, or it's unfair that I have to suffer. Because we should be able to solve my problem by now.
Exactly. Absolutely right. I think it fundamentally comes down to society being constructed in a way that we think we are entitled to good health, a long life, and good intellect the whole time. When really the only thing that's guaranteed is death, unfortunately. Yeah. And so when we get sick or older or die, it's received with such shock and horror and a failure of doctors or whoever it is that this should happen, when really it's the only thing that's guaranteed. You're absolutely right. We have almost a sense of entitlement, I think, that we should.
Wow.
I joked that's going to fall on my head.
Right? And I mean, you are entitled to a safe podcasting space where something would not fall from the ceiling on your head and kill you.
But should I get it?
Nothing is guaranteed. Let's take a break. We're back from the break. We have fixed up whatever that was about to fall on Prachi's head and guillotine her.
I'm alive. It's all good.
Hallelujah. I don't have a lawsuit on my hand. Do you think your parents would actually sue me, though? Because your family knows my family, right?
No, I don't think so. I think
would your husband sue me, though?
No, he wouldn't.
Nah. Well, you're your parents' only child, so I can completely understand if, you know, they lose it. And you're also your husband's only wife, so.
This is true, as far as I know, yes.
So coming back to your point about us feeling a sense of entitlement, yeah, it's true. There's a sense of comfort that if something will happen to me, people will find a way to cure me. Mm. Actually, us living longer and becoming older than we have been in the past is one of the reasons why we're getting cancer. So older people are more likely to get cancer. Is that right?
Older people are more likely to get cancer.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's not all cancers, but certain type of cancers. Things like bowel cancer, breast cancer, lung cancer, the more common cancers are in general more common in elderly population. And there's a whole variety of reasons for that in terms of how good our cells are at replicating our DNA. The errors that we make when we replicate our DNA are higher the older we get, and the inability to fix those errors as well is greater. But there's also other factors as well. Things like our lifestyle, that's another big factor. And the common things that people hear about are still very much relevant in terms of causing cancer. So smoking, drinking, obesity, bad or sedentary lifestyle, they're known risk factors.
Yeah.
And arguably we are not living as healthy as we were a few generations ago. So that's certainly going to be causing it. Other things as well, like radiation. Back in the day, you know, Chernobyl was a classic example. But these days, radiation, whether it's from potentially from mobile phones, 4G, travel in a plane, you know, that all those sorts of things as well, small amounts of radiation.
Yeah.
So I think we're living longer. Yes, that's a cause. Our lifestyle has changed. That's a cause. But also we're better at diagnosing cancer these days, far better than we were. So there are probably people dying, you know, a few decades ago that they probably died because of cancer. We just didn't know it at that point.
Right.
So our methodology of detecting cancer is far better these days. We can pick things up earlier. And people are also more aware of lumps and bumps that shouldn't be there and seek help earlier as well. I think there's a few reasons why we're seeing it more and more.
Okay. Mm. So our generation is actually facing more cancer because of our lifestyle, but also maybe cancer has always been there to a large extent, but it was attributed to natural causes. Or
I think to a small extent that might be true. I can't really say that was definitely the case. We're living longer, our lifestyle and detecting things earlier that were probably there would have gone missed.
Yeah.
I think all of those reasons are why.
Yeah, I mean, look, in older generations, people died more easily of diseases that are now quite preventable.
Mm.
So they probably didn't have the time to develop cancer in aging bodies.
Yeah, absolutely. Like the median age for a male was about 60, 65. Now we're easily saying 80, 85, and women it's closer to 90.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, that last two decades that we've gained in our life, that's the highest risk where you are to develop cancer. So, as you said, people were probably dying of heart disease or something else before they had time to develop cancer.
Yeah. But also then these people that are becoming those age have spent their life sitting a lot. Not maybe the generation that's now in their 80s and 90s, but certainly you and me well, not you because you're on your feet all day, but me and other people like me, when we're in our 80s and 90s, we will have spent our whole lives sitting in front of a computer a lot. Mm-hmm. And I was reading on the internet that millennials have much higher incidence of obesity than older generations, and obesity is linked to certain types of cancers.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, people classically identify smoking and drinking as a potential cause of cancer, but it's often overlooked that obesity, or more importantly, a sedentary lifestyle, direct causes for almost every cancer, but most commonly we think of breast cancer, bowel cancer, lung cancer as well. That a lack of people going out and seeing sunlight and being active on their feet, and everything you do these days, you can sit at your desk. You don't have to go and get your groceries. You can just order them online. You don't have to, you know, everything can be brought to you. So, I think the everyday steps that people take has diminished significantly. So you can go your whole day without having to leave your house. Mm. And when I'm often talking to my patients and educating them on being active and exercising, the most frequent response I get is my patients tell me, oh, but I walk to the bus stop every day to get to work, or I walk my dog every day. And I have to tell them that's a normal expected part of daily activity. That does not classify as exercise. You know, that's what people were doing every day all the time anyway, walking to work or walking, you know, riding their bike, catching the bus. On top of that baseline activity, you need to be doing proper exercise that's dedicated to just you and the cardio or weight exercise that you're doing. And even the type of exercise that people do, you know, they don't do it properly. They might, and this is definitely a case of do as I say, not as I do. But, you know, people will go for a walk for 20 minutes and they'll say, I exercised. But when they come back from their walk, they're perfectly chipper and they're able to pick up the phone and talk to their friend or carry on with their daily routine. Really, if you've exercised properly, you should be tired and fatigued and sweaty for a good 5 to 10 minutes and catching your breath. And that's a sign that you've got your heart rate up and you've done the right exercise. And all of these sorts of things, if people do it, hopefully, it'll reduce their risk of cancer.
So. Mm. And there are different guidelines about that. Mm. For example, there was this old Japanese guideline of 10,000 steps a day.
Mm.
But there's different guidelines for different populations. And and sometimes it's a matter of any exercise is better than no exercise.
Absolutely.
But always, I think, trying to improve on your movement, increase your movement should be the goal, rather than being complacent.
Exactly.
I'm only ever going to do this much. Well, if today I can only do 20 minutes, today I'll do 20 minutes. But always my goal is to do more.
To do more and to make it a priority. I think that's become exceedingly difficult in our lifestyle these days. To make exercise a priority is just incredibly difficult. We're always on. From the minute we open our eyes, our phone's there. We can check our email. We've got people expecting things from us, work to do. When we come home, we've got this, that, and the other. And so that dedicated me time to actually exercise has become very difficult. Yeah,
we have in all of this lost a lot of our connection to our bodies and the way in which our lives before were very physical. We're very connected to the land and everything. I know that this is sounding very kind of woo-woo, but now most of our economy is largely a knowledge-based economy. We have obviously still got physical work that happens in our economy, like agriculture, manufacturing, or construction, but a large number of people are in jobs that just require them to use their brains, not their bodies anymore.
Absolutely. Absolutely right.
And our lives are in a large part virtual and facilitated by machinery like vehicles and phones. So in that sense, our reliance on our bodies as machines and in themselves to get things done is quite low now. And that has profound implications, like not just cancer, but mental health, a sense of social isolation and disconnection. Like getting more exercise in your day could often mean that you, in a society where everyone tried to do that, could often mean more engaging with other humans.
Definitely.
In many ways, but
definitely. And we know that that in general, in Australian kids, for example, are participating less and less in team sports. That's why there's such a drive to get more people to play cricket or soccer or football, whatever it is, because probably with the spending more time on their gadgets, watching a video, working out their thumbs more than their bodies. And absolutely that social and emotional benefit that comes from interacting with people for physical activity cannot match that.
And the thing of making physical activity a priority. So we have this notion of self-care, which is a big thing now, everywhere on social media as well. But often this idea of self-care as exercising in order to service the machine of our bodies, keep the parts moving, is so missing. And I see it in not so much in our generation, but funnily enough, in my personal experience, anecdotally, I see it more in the generation of my parents, like baby boomers and Gen X, who spent all their time working for their kids and their priority was their children. And so self-care is like this guilty luxury activity that sometimes might happen.
Absolutely.
But not so much that self-centered focus of my body's a machine too and I need to keep it functioning properly.
Exactly. I think you're right. The older generation does, and I think typically migrant families as well,
yes,
they find it very difficult to give any sort of time to themselves.
Yeah.
It is viewed as a guilty pleasure, embarrassing, I shouldn't be doing this. How can I prioritize 30 minutes of my day just to me and my well-being? I struggle with my parents as well. And there's always work to do. There's always something else to do. And now it's very cool and hip in our generation or younger generations to say, oh, I've got me time. But often that's some Instagram post about lighting a scented candle and having a bubble bath. But what does that actually mean? And are you genuinely exercising and not pretending like you've gone on a hike for Instagram? genuine exercise that's very difficult.
But of course, I think now government is putting a lot of messaging into getting people to exercise.
Yeah.
Like, for example, Vic government has this new campaign called This Girl Can, which is to encourage women to exercise.
Yep.
And like you said, sporting organizations and government are trying to encourage children to play more sport.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. You see it on billboards and on the side of buses that, be active, go and move your body. It's a huge push.
Yeah.
But I think to say that is one thing. To do it, obviously, is a different thing. It takes your mindset to make it a priority. You need to be organized and make time in your day for that as well, and have the means to do it as well and the support.
Yeah, there is a lot of, there are socioeconomic factors in there that, for example, your job status. If you're a parent working very hard, multiple jobs to support your family, you may not have the time to exercise. If you are disabled, if you don't have the access to the knowledge and awareness of, how to exercise best, or if you're depressed and you don't have access to healthcare in order to alleviate your depression and want to exercise. So there are lots of factors. Nutrition as well,
absolutely.
Socioeconomic factors affect the nutrition available to people.
Absolutely.
Tremendously.
Absolutely.
Do you find that in your work as an oncologist, there is any correlation between cancer and socioeconomic groups?
Definitely, most definitely. It's interesting because I did the first 5 or 6 years of my training at the Alfred Hospital, which is based in Toorak. Mm-hmm. So the demographics of patients I saw there were one end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, and this is a generalization, but in general, I saw Caucasian patients who were in general well-to-do. A lot of patients had private health insurance, or even if they didn't, they looked after themselves. They exercised, they went to yoga, they didn't smoke, they didn't drink, they had a full-time job. That was one end of the spectrum. And then 2 years ago, I went to Northern Hospital in Epping, which was a completely different set of patients, absolutely the other end of the spectrum. The vast majority of patients I saw were immigrants and recent immigrants, so they couldn't speak English, which meant that every consultation took 3 times long because we needed an interpreter.
Right.
Health literacy was rock bottom.
Mm-hmm.
No one exercised. Almost everyone smoked. And with that, all the other, implications as well. Alcohol was rampant. Illicit drugs were rampant. Sedentary lifestyle. They didn't understand what it meant to take care of oneself. And yeah, I know smoking can cause cancer, but I don't want to stop. That motivation was not there. And their children were suffering as well. The whole family was like that. And there were huge rates of cancers and different types of cancers. So typically, I would see much more lung cancer because the smoking incidence was so high.
Right.
And also presentations were very late. So people would often let a lump or a bump or a symptom go on for many months before seeking medical attention. So often I was diagnosing patients in a far later stage of their illness than in a different hospital.
Is that an attitude problem, or is that because they didn't have access to health insurance, so they didn't want to keep, were not able to claim from Medicare?
It was both. So I often saw people who knew something was wrong, but they were scared. They didn't realize that often in an early stage of a cancer, it is still curable. Mm-hmm. And they would think, well, I've got a cough. This is it. I'm done. And so they'll sit on it until they were in extremis and then present to us. And then, of course, by that stage, we really couldn't do much. But then there was also refugees who didn't have a Medicare number. They didn't have access to all the services that we did. So there was that fear as well financially. Well, if I go to a doctor, I'm going to have to pay millions of dollars to get treatment. You know, all sorts of things. There was cultural issues where the older migrants would say, oh, well, you know, I don't want to be examined by a male doctor, or I don't want to go to a doctor that doesn't speak my language, or I'll take this herbal supplement and I'll get better. You know, all sorts of different viewpoints. So very different depending on which pocket of, and this is all within Melbourne, you know, all within 30 kilometres of Melbourne, extremely different health literacy and subsequent cancer rates and treatment that I would see. It's really quite astonishing, I thought.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so fascinating. And even as you speak, I'm becoming so aware of my own privilege as somebody that has private health insurance, that has the financial means to go and seek the advice of any number of specialists.
Exactly.
If there was something wrong with me, and keep going back again and again until I found a solution.
Yep, absolutely.
Whereas, is cancer treatment affordable? Does the government make that affordable to people that need it?
Absolutely. So if you go through a public hospital, you essentially don't pay anything for really impressive chemotherapy, immunotherapy, all the new agents that we're using, radiation therapy, all the scans that you have, all the visits that you make, all your medications. You might be out of pocket $10, $20 for a few extra nausea tablets, but that's about it, which is really amazing. And I often do have to stress this to my patients, that actually what you've had up until this point has been a privilege and you really haven't had to pay a cent. And so I think the Australian healthcare system is actually amazing. When we, as much as it cops negative press, if we compare Australia to other countries, the States, or even other European or Asian countries, we are very lucky to be able to access a lot of things essentially free of charge. It is different if you go to a private health system, and we can talk about that for a long time. But in general, again, the majority of things there are you don't have to pay for, but you will be out of pocket for a few extra things. But that, of course, is, there's pros and cons to that. So, yeah.
Wow. Cancer is something which is unpredictable, and it can happen to anyone regardless of their health status.
Absolutely.
Regardless of how healthy their bodies are.
Absolutely. Cancer doesn't discriminate. It can happen to anyone at any time, whether they're fit or not, whether they're young or old.
Mm.
Yes, there are things you can do to minimize your risk, but absolutely there's no guarantee that you won't get it.
Yeah.
And there are pills or tablets to make you feel better to a certain extent, whether it's cancer or not, but ultimately it doesn't provide the answer to everything. And that's why we always say prevention is better than, you know, treatment.
But there's no prevention for cancer, essentially.
Generally not. Mm.
How many young people do you see on average? Do you see more older people, or do you see a good mix of young and old, both?
I generally see older people. That's primarily because I'm an adult oncologist as opposed to a pediatric oncologist who would see infants.
Yeah.
But I definitely see young people in their 20s and 30s. There are less common, so in general I'd see people over the age of 50. But I definitely see young people, and it's incredibly hard because you can almost you can relate to these patients, you know. And the common cancers I guess that affect young people are breast cancer, bowel cancer. There's particular rare types of cancers like sarcoma, which is cancer of the soft tissues or bones, that has a tendency to occur in young teenagers or 20-year-olds. So it's definitely there in young people. I've seen an 18-year-old with melanoma on her head, you know. So it's common. It's something that's not often talked about, I think. We often think of cancer as a disease of the old or a disease of the very young,
mm.
you know, of young kids that you imagine with leukemia who are bald that you see on children's hospital, you know. But there's definitely cancer in the 20s, 30s, 40s spectrum, which is definitely not talked about a lot.
Mm.
I think it should be. And often patients in that age group who have cancer have not, I guess it's got nothing to do with their lifestyle. It is purely bad luck, so to speak, that they've been diagnosed. Having said that, they generally tolerate treatment much better than older patients.
Yeah.
And they generally do better, but there's exceptions. Yeah.
Yeah. So is cancer, I have this fear sometimes that it's like lightning. You never know when it'll strike you, or, you know, so this bad luck element of cancer, is it just like you're sitting or standing or sleeping or whatever, and just one cell decides to suddenly start mutating?
Yep.
And affects the cells around it randomly.
Yeah. So we actually are all sitting ducks to get cancer, which is a really scary thought. Mm. And it makes you value each day so much more. But that's right. So the fundamental basis of cancer is one cell has gone wrong and haywire, and it's multiplying rapidly. And actually, we're constantly replicating ourselves, and we're constantly making mistakes. And our body is able to find those errors and either fix them or kill off that dodgy cell. But for some reason in cancer, those checks and balances go out of whack, and that one bad cell continues to replicate. So really, we are a sitting duck for that check and balance to go off, and then it takes away. It goes off, and that's it. Yeah.
But there are a few diagnoses, I think, that people would feel absolutely devastated about.
Mm.
If you found out that, for example, you have HIV,
mm-hmm.
AIDS, if you found out that you have, you know, some kind of organ failure,
mm.
and if you found out that you have cancer, this is like the nightmare situation for anyone to imagine. Like, what's the worst thing that could happen? You go to a doctor and they say, you have cancer.
Yeah.
Or that's the whole joke about people looking up their symptoms on WebMD. And it's like, this could be related to heartburn or stomach cancer.
Yeah.
So
it's always written there as a disclaimer, and it could be cancer. Yeah.
The cancer is scary.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But if we had more awareness to go and get checked earlier, could we catch it earlier?
Absolutely.
Is there a future in which cancer is not a death sentence?
You're touching a nerve of mine that I'm very passionate about.
Okay.
I think exactly what you said, cancer has been and it still is scary. And it's been classically portrayed as that's it.
Mm.
You've got cancer, you may as well start digging your grave. You know, it's classically thought of that. And even 20, 30 years ago, HIV was thought of as that because we didn't have any treatments. And now HIV treatment is completely different. We have excellent tablet antivirals, and people can take those tablets every day, and they are living extraordinarily good and long lives, almost the same as the average population, without any issues. And no one would even know that that person has HIV. And now our mindset has probably or should be changing that if someone is diagnosed with HIV, it's turned into a chronic disease rather than a death sentence.
Right.
And you take your tablets and you're fine.
Right.
As long as you're compliant with those tablets.
Yeah.
Same thing is happening for cancer oncology.
Oh,
and every time I say that to, you know, I say, see a patient, immediately their face is exactly what, you know, you just had the alarm and the fright and the terror that this is it for me.
Mm.
And we always say to our patients, look, we are trying to make cancer oncology turn into a chronic disease. And
right. Majority of cancer and HIV the new diabetes.
Yeah, exactly.
Just managing it.
Exactly. And right. I say to my patients almost every day, you know, cancer is now a chronic disease. And there are many, many hundreds, thousands of patients out there with cancer who are walking around on the streets, going about their daily lives, and you wouldn't even know that. And it is the new diabetes, you know, where if you take your medications, your health is maintained. It's not always the case, and it's generally infrequently the case, that patients can live for many decades with a cancer diagnosis. That's uncommon if we catch it in a late stage.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole point of, I guess, our job and all the things you see in the in society is from the government, all the government incentives is to diagnose cancer early. So, for example, when someone turns 50, they get a kit in the mail, which is everyone looks forward to, which is to check, to collect a stool sample and send it off to the government. And the whole point of that is to catch bowel cancer early, because we know that if we catch bowel cancer early, we can generally get away with just an operation and the person is cured.
Yeah.
And we never use the word cure in oncology, but we are definitely trying to use it more and more, because if we're able to catch cancers early, they're absolutely curable.
Oh, good.
The same thing is very much a case for breast cancer. Mm. We know that women are, again, free of charge. This is all free. Every 2 years, they can get a mammogram through Breast Screen, which is pretty much in every suburb in Victoria. And again, the whole point of that is that if a breast cancer is caught early, they just need a small operation and people are cured.
Okay.
And we pride ourselves on being able to use the word cure, because it's something that historically we've never been able to do.
Wow.
But we're using it more and more. But ultimately, this again relies on people being aware of health, health literacy, and being aware that these tests are out there, and then when they do receive the package in the mail, or they do receive a letter reminder saying have your mammogram, they actually go and do it and follow up with it.
And not just be like, ah, this is, you know,
I don't need this, I'm young. Exactly.
Or like, oh yeah, I'll get to it eventually, and then forget about it. How young should girls and women start screening for breast cancer?
So it's not recommended, unless you have, so people who don't have a family history, then the government will send you a letter generally, or GP should remind you, roughly in the ages of 50, from the age of 50 onwards, where you have mammogram every 2 years. It's different though, depending on your family history. So if your mum or aunt or sister has been diagnosed with breast cancer, particularly at a younger age, I'm not talking about over the age of 80, but at a younger age, then potentially your risk could be higher than the average population. So we always recommend that you go and talk to your GP and say, look, I've got two women in my family who've been diagnosed with breast cancer in their 40s. I'm in my 30s. Do I need to do something different? Do I need to have mammograms or MRIs of my breast earlier? So it is different to every different, you know, every different person. But in general, it's, after the age of 40, 50.
But now there's a lot more awareness that men can get breast cancer too.
Mm.
So how can men screen for breast cancer?
So again, the same rules, I guess, apply. For men, in general, the men who get breast cancer are those who've got a family history. And it's in general if they've got a genetic mutation, so BRCA gene, which famously, you know, Angelina Jolie has
had the BRCA mutation.
And that's why she's had the mastectomy. So typically men who have breast cancer classically have that gene. And so often they will know that they have that gene already because someone else in their family
got it.
Mm-hmm. But absolutely, there are still men who they are the ones who are the first person to have that genetic mutation and they don't know. So having that check, similarly for men, having a prostate cancer check, you know, having the bowel cancer check, all of those things all comes hand in hand. So a lot of people don't see their GP for years on end, and the GP is kind of like a dentist. You only need them once in a while, but when you need them, you really need them.
Right.
We're encouraging people to not do that and see their GP at least once a year regularly, because your GP is a wealth of knowledge.
Yeah.
And they're often the person who can say, hey, you're turning 40 next year. This means that you now have to do X, Y, Z.
So there's two points. I want to come back to something you said, but just quickly, this idea of going to the GP, I think we need to, or the idea of responding to the government's letter to get a bowel cancer, prostate cancer check, is that we need to understand that if we can't just say, oh, cancer is something that happens to other people, or be so scared of it that you just refuse to acknowledge that it could happen to you.
Exactly.
That we need to understand that it could happen to all of us and take it seriously every time there is advice from a GP or a government letter.
Yep.
Just believe that it could happen to us too.
Absolutely. People are often paralyzed with fear and paralyzed to inaction. That's one thing. But also there's this sense of ignorance, but I don't know what to call it, that, oh, it doesn't affect me, I'll be fine.
Yeah.
When we, and yet they know all these friends or family members where someone just like them has been affected.
Yeah,
so that's the most scary thing about cancer, that it can happen to anyone at any point.
Yeah.
And that's what distinguishes it from diabetes or heart attacks in general.
Yeah.
And I think the most important message is that, you know, you have to stop and think, hang on, why is the government spending thousands of dollars to send out these letters and kits every 2 years to every person in Australia? What could the government possibly, why would they want to do that? There must be some financial incentive for that, because we all know that money is really the government's, you know, driving factor. And we've known from our population research that by detecting cancers early, yes, we're able to cure people, but the same people are able to get back to work and contribute to society again. And it's far cheaper to treat people early on than later on when they're in a stage four or incurable sense.
Yeah.
We can't do anything about it. So there's so many things, and people, it all comes back to what we were saying before, that people think, if I get cancer, that's it, I'm done. And that mentality just has to change, and people have to understand that if we catch it early, you're not done. You might have a few months of discomfort where you're in and out of hospital, you're not able to work, but at the end of it, you're completely fine and you are able to resume your normal life. And people have to keep that in mind before, you know, when they get these tests in the mail. I still see women where they've had a, you know, these are educated women who are working, who've got a young family, everyone's very well to do, and they'll have a breast in their lump, and they would have had it for 14-15 months, and they will hide it from their husband or hide it from their partner and not tell anyone about it, and then they present in a very late stage and we can't do anything about it.
And I mean, the whole thing, you were trying to prevent your family from the pain, but you know, actually
but in that point they've gone from being curable to incurable, you know, and if they had told us day one, we really could have helped them. So The realization that the treatment of cancer has changed and it's improved to such a point that we can actually cure a lot of our patients.
Wow.
That's what, people need to realize.
This is so good. This is actually alleviating my own fear.
Mm.
Recently, a couple of friends told me that their parents have cancer.
Mm.
And that was one of the things that prompted me to do this podcast, because I was feeling like, oh my God, people around me are getting cancer.
Mm.
So many people are getting cancer. What's going on? But this is really helping me personally as well to feel that, okay, this can be, you know, this can be a manageable condition if we get on it early.
Exactly. It all comes back to getting on it early. You know, having said that, there are some things that you can catch more easily early. Mm-hmm. Breast cancer, typical one, where because you can feel it or see it. But unfortunately, there's other cancers that are internal, often bowel cancer, where sometimes people present at a late stage and we can't do anything about it. But absolutely, if we're able to catch it early, it's a whole different discussion. Yeah.
So breast cancer has a really great PR team. Breast cancer is like the best known cancer.
Absolutely. It's the poster child of cancer, I say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that just because it is the most common cancer, or is it because it's just been championed more broadly?
I think that it's better? The latter, the championing of it. It is one of the more common cancers, but it's not probably the most common cancer.
What is the most common cancer that you see?
That I see? Well, in general, in Australia, prostate cancer is quite common.
Okay.
Breast cancer is up there. Lung cancer has the highest, I guess, number in sheer numbers, and skin cancer and melanoma. They're the top four common cancers in Australia.
Right.
Currently where I'm working, the hospital sees mainly melanoma patients, skin cancer patients, but I see all of the others as well. There's no escape. You know, those cancers are very common. But I think breast cancer has been championed a lot, and there's a whole reasons for that. It's got a lot of funding compared to other tumor types. It affects women in general, and in general, again, a generalization, but in general, women are more aware of their bodies. They have louder voices when it comes to campaigning for more money or awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got people like Glenn McGrath, you know, his wife died from breast cancer, and he's got this huge McGrath Foundation. Every year, one of the cricket matches turns pink, and you see the breast cancer slogans and ribbons everywhere, on billboards, on buses, you know, all of those sorts of things. Everyone knows about breast cancer. You've got mammograms that are available, you know, all of that. As opposed to something like prostate cancer, where it only affects men, and in general, men have less, I guess, worries about their health. They don't tend to be as active when it comes to going to GPs and having a test. And if they are diagnosed with prostate cancer, it's often underplayed. I'm all right, I'll be fine, it's okay. that might be a factor in terms of why we see or hear less about prostate cancer. Bowel cancer is another very big one that affects both men and women.
Right.
And there isn't, I would argue that, there's far less awareness and funding behind bowel cancer than there is about for breast cancer.
Right.
And you see ads on TVs, I don't know if you've seen it, it's just going around the last few weeks, about smoking, and smoking causes lung cancer, but it also causes bladder cancer and this cancer and that cancer. So we're slowly starting to make headway in terms of other types of cancers,
right?
But definitely breast cancer is the poster child.
We definitely need more awareness of other types of cancers, and there's so much misinformation out there. For example, I recently stopped using antiperspirants, aluminium-based antiperspirants, because there was all of this information out there that those block the glands and that causes cancer. Now, as it turns out, for me personally, the natural deodorant works for my body better at controlling my odor. But now I've recently, also at your wedding, from your colleague, I forget her name, Vanessa? Yeah. So she also told me, so just before leaving, my sister and I, we were like, wait. So just before we go, do those antiperspirants cause breast cancer? And she just goes, no. Like, she had heard this so many times that she was like, not today. Not at my friend's wedding. No. and so I was like, oh, wow. I was just like embarrassed. Like, here I have been trying to convince the women in my family to stop using those damn antiperspirants, but actually it doesn't do anything. So why is this misinformation so common? Where does it come from? Who starts spreading these rumors?
I think it all comes back to people out there playing on people's fear. We are all terrified, petrified that we will get cancer, and we all want to have some sort of control over our future and our health. What can we do right now that's in my hands? What can I control so that I don't have any, there's no remote chance that I have contributed to me getting cancer. And if I do get cancer in the future, it was purely out of bad luck rather than me having contributed to it. That is the fundamental reason why all of this is out there. And the sources are infinite. Often it is a medical person or a pseudo-medical person, or it's just come from a family member of someone who's had cancer, or a patient themselves. Often, more often than not, it's actually the marketing, the product, the company behind it that's done that.
And they can just get away with saying crap like this?
Absolutely, and it's not regulated. I think there's a few things here. So there is a lot of information about causes of cancer, whether that's deodorant, the things we eat, the things we drink, the things we're exposed to, anything and everything. Somehow, somewhere, someone wants to link it with cancer because it all comes down to that fear that this could be contributing. Fundamentally, we don't know a lot of the answers to those things. We don't know if deodorants, for example, 100% have a link with cancer or not. And that's because it's almost impossible, if you think about it, to study that in a robust way. You can't get 1,000 people, give them deodorant type A, deodorant type B, and then watch them for the rest of their lives. And if some people develop cancer and some don't, you can't say, well, that was because of deodorant A, You can't say that because there's so many other confounding factors. Those 100 people may have all been smokers, So it's almost impossible to study a lot of these things, like deodorant, to say, has it caused cancer or has it not? And it's often not the case that things are one-to-one. And we'd like things to be simple in our head. We like to say, right, deodorant causes cancer, therefore I'm not going to use deodorant. But it's never that simple, and cancer is far more complicated than that. So I think we can never say never. We can't say definitely not. But we know certainly right now that it doesn't absolutely cause it either, because if that was the case, we would be seeing, everyone who uses Lynx deodorant or the vast majority of people is getting cancer. So that we would have already realized that. So there's no point in making your life miserable or changing your lifestyle and constantly worrying about it and making changes to your life when it actually has nothing to do with cancer. It's not going to cause it, and it's just causing anxiety and fear. So there's things, I see people all the time that say, oh, well, I read on the internet that sugar causes cancer.
Yeah, where's that coming from?
And that's because, at least this is my understanding of it, and I could be wrong, I think people have boiled down very complicated scientific concepts to very simple things, and that's the problem.
Or they have generalized. So, for example, if sugar is touted as the enemy for health and for increasing the risk of getting diabetes type 2, then people have just said sugar is universally bad.
Exactly.
And sugar causes cancer as well.
Exactly. Cancer's become this catchphrase at the end of everything. Oh, and it could cause cancer, you know.
Yeah.
I think for sugar, for example, there's all this rubbish out there that sugar causes cancer. And that it keeps coming back to the fact that there's no one cause of cancer.
Yeah.
And actually, the majority of people who get cancer are just bad luck.
Yeah. But there are a few things. For example, sun exposure, smoking, eating a lot of like spicy foods.
So there are things that we know do cause cancer.
Okay.
Absolutely. So smoking, as we said, alcohol, that's another big one, which I think is very overlooked.
Yeah. A lot of people go smoking causes lung cancer, but the impact of alcohol on diseases is not well discussed.
Exactly. And I think that's a lot to do with Australian culture in particular.
Right.
As you said, we know smoking causes lung cancer, but now we're trying to tell people that smoking also causes many other cancers, not just lung cancer. And with alcohol, it's so rampant in our society. You know, it is so common for people to drink a glass or two of wine a night with their dinner, to have beer on the weekend or whatever, you know, pleasure that people derive from it. At the same time, it's a carcinogen and people skim over that fact. So alcohol, yes.
Yeah.
Acidic foods or pickled foods, there's been an association with stomach cancer, gastric cancer. But again, people think, oh, well, I'm not going to eat any acidic food. I'm not going to eat pickles, you know. But it's only in extremes that that's the case.
So it's only like if you're constantly getting heartburn.
Exactly.
And you're esophagus is constantly getting burnt by stomach acids, then you might have that risk of, because there's like burning happening in there.
Absolutely. And we know that chronic reflux that's not treated definitely is a strong risk factor for causing esophageal.
But that could also be because of anxiety or other factors that could cause chronic reflux.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's about making sure that that's controlled.
Right. It's become quite widely accepted now that processed meats of some sorts are carcinogens, and if consumed in excess could lead to cancer.
I think processed meats or processed foods in general, who knows what's in it, the toxins, the chemicals, even the same thing, you know, from fertilizers, from vegetables.
Right.
So we know, or we hypothesize that these things cause cancer. Again, it's almost impossible to prove this because you just cannot make that an independent factor to study. There is a lot of misinformation out there, and it's one of the most difficult things of my job, where people have quote unquote done their research on the internet and they come to you thinking that they're full of knowledge and they've read all the facts and they know exactly what they want. And then here you are trying to say, well, actually sugar doesn't cause cancer, and let's try and break down why people have said that. And getting back to your initial question, it's probably because all our cells, we rely on sugar for energy, for cell replication. So people think that if you deprive yourself of sugar, you're starving the cancer cells and they're going to die. But it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You know, we all have carbohydrates in our diet. If we don't, we create it from fat and proteins. You need it to live. And eliminating sugar from your tea has no effect whatsoever on cancer.
Yeah. In fact, such things probably make people that have cancer feel just bad. Like, you didn't do enough to stop it.
Exactly.
You got cancer because you ate sugar and blah, 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 blah. It's, you know, imagine if you're peddling alkaline diets, for example, to people. Drink alkaline water or any other these weird, these quackery things that are happening. Like, all of this quackery makes the people that actually have cancer feel like just chumps.
Exactly.
Like, oh, and I guess I didn't try hard enough.
Exactly. Yeah. And I often get questions from patients saying, well, they might not work, but what's the harm in doing it? And I say, well, there is harm. Firstly, on your mental health, because exactly as you say, people are thinking, oh, you know, I had too much sugar, I'm going to cut out sugar. But also it's making your lifestyle miserable. You now have to drink this disgusting alkaline water when you don't need to. It's making your life miserable. But also a lot of these things have direct implications on the chemotherapy that the patient may be using and making them ineffective. They're all toxic to the liver. You know, I had a patient who took high doses of vitamin C, because there's a lot of information out there that vitamin C helps or cures, treats cancer. And a lot of people think, well, there's no harm in trying, but there actually is. And this guy ended up with liver failure because of the vitamin C. And these are the things, these are the information, you know, this won't be out there. The people who are out there trying to sell these alternative or quack ideas, yeah. they'll gloss over and barely mention that actually these are still active agents.
Yeah.
They can cause damage themselves and they can lessen the benefit of the chemo or whatever it is that you're taking as well. So it's really hard to educate people. And there's this conspiracy, I think, out there that I think people think that there's some cure of cancer out there, that there's something out there that doctors are intentionally withholding, you know?
Do you know, I've read this in researching for this episode.
Yeah.
I typed up cancer myths in Google. And every article that I read, the last point was there's a theory that big pharma and medical industries are withholding a cancer treatment in order to get... So you hear this a lot? Doctors hear this a lot?
I hear this sometimes and okay. I can't help but laugh because to me it is so, the idea is so ridiculous and it is so fundamentally wrong. I can't believe that people would genuinely believe that there's a pharmaceutical company or there are doctors or there's someone in a lab coat somewhere, you know, like a movie hiding the cure for cancer in a little petri dish and not showing anyone. Like, it's the most outrageous and wrong thing, and it just defies logic to me. There are so many issues I have with that. You know, there's so many checks and balances that we have in our society to make sure that whatever medication it is, even the earliest, you know, if we've tried something on mice and it showed any hint of being effective, it immediately gets, the production of it gets accelerated and we immediately start trying to see if we can apply it for humans and if it can be, you know, there to help. People like me, we wake up every day to try and help people with cancer and cure cancer. So there is just no conspiracy that, you know, something's hidden amongst the billionaire pharmaceutical companies. It's illegal, it's wrong, it's unethical, it just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
It just makes me wonder why people think that. And I think, again, it all fundamentally comes down to this desperation that people have, that there must be a cure out there, but someone's hiding it.
Yeah.
And it's sad that people have such mistrust in the medical system or the healthcare system in general.
There's a lot of there's the same people that are peddling these snake oils like alkaline water. That a lot of these people also have these off the grid, like, you know, live off the grid, don't trust the government, the medical industry is out to cheat you.
Anti-vaxxers, of that kind of stuff. Absolutely. That's a whole nother podcast.
Yes, I actually want to get into that because I think it really affects us. And it's not healthy for public discourse to have that floating around.
This is the thing that in today's society, it's such an advantage that we've got all of this information out there. And it's excellent when I can have a good, robust, high-level discussion with a patient who's done their reading. It's really challenging and fun for me. But at the same time, there's so many incorrect bits of information out there that people read and they take as gospel, you know. And to have to undo all of that is an immense amount of work.
So is the best solution for not falling prey to this quackery is, if you have a cancer diagnosis, then how do you know what information is, how can an average person know that the information they're reading online is valid, or should they only ever be getting information from their doctor?
I think fundamentally you need to trust your doctor. There is a reason why they have gone to university and done all of that teaching and learning. And if you think that you know as much as them or almost as much as them from a quick Google search, you really need to look at yourself. And a lot of people don't like hearing that, but there is this sense of arrogance almost that people can look on the internet and know everything about a condition. If that was the case, people like me would be out of a job. So the first most important thing is trust your health professional and be humble. It's a very humbling experience if you have to go to someone and they say, hang on, what you've read is wrong. These are the right things, but you just have to listen to them. And I think that sense of almost respect has gone out the window these days. So trust your health professional. They know what they're talking about. They're in this business for a reason. They will point you in the right direction. And if you're not happy with them, go to another health professional.
Right.
If you want to read something on the internet or research, they will also point you in the right direction.
Right.
We know what the credible sources are. We know what the credible internet resources are. And I definitely encourage patients to go and read and learn about their condition. It's very empowering and it's very important. But you need to know where to get that information from. And just because someone or something has an MD next to their name doesn't mean it's the right thing. And often things that are written in the US are not applicable to people in Australia and vice versa. So ask them for information, ask for printouts and, you know, guidelines and things to read, and you'll get all of that information from a credible source. And I always say to people, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Yeah.
So if you're going to buy a vitamin that says cures cancer, it's too good to be true.
Yeah, yeah.
And if my job is as easy as prescribing a vitamin, then fantastic. So if something is costing you money, you have to have a really good look at it.
Because if something is costing you money and if something is on top of your treatment and the discomfort and the pain of your treatment on your condition is causing you extra heartache, extra stress, like, for example, waking up at 5 a.m. to juice.
Yeah.
Or drink bazillion alkaline smoothies in a day. If that is all affecting you and that's become your obsession and you're not able to in any way participate with your family or in your work.
Yeah. And I encourage people, you know, people want to be intellectual and they want to read about their condition and learn about it. Fantastic. But if you're going to be intellectual, you really need to really think about what you're reading. Alkaline water is a classic example. I had a patient just a couple of days ago. She was a chemist and she had cancer. And she was walking in some supermarket and or some place, and a man was selling alkaline water to her. And he said, you know, alkaline water, it makes your pH alkaline. That kills cancer cells. You need it, this, that, and the other. She had a look at it. It was a few hundred dollars. And initially she, you know, looking at this guy, and salesmen are salesmen for a reason. Mm. You know, he was convincing. She said, yes, I want all the things I can do, everything I can do to help me. And she was about to buy it. And then she said to the guy, she said, hang on, but I know from my chemistry background or basic science that I learned in high school that our stomachs are acidic. So as soon as I drink this water, is it not going to go into my stomach and turn acidic? Very easy to, you know, conceptualize question, I thought, which a lot of people, even without a science background, should be thinking about. And he said, oh, no, 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 this water doesn't go into your stomach because it'll get acidic. It gets absorbed through your skin.
Oh, my God.
And it goes to your lung where your lung cancer is. And at that, she thought, this is absolutely ridiculous. Put the bottle down and walked away. But, you know, this is such an easy concept to understand. People should think, hang on, how the hell is this water going to stay alkaline in my body? It just absolutely doesn't make sense. Mm. And there's so many things like that I could go on and on where just a little bit of extra thought, people will think, hang on, this doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
It's just too good to be true. And if it works, why is it costing me hundreds of dollars? Why isn't my doctor giving it to me? You know? So people just need to be so careful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it all comes back to the fact that people are vulnerable.
Yeah.
And these companies are prying on people's vulnerability. They're prying on people's wanting to have control, something they can do to help their condition.
Yeah.
And so people will buy the alkaline water because they think, well, why not?
Yeah.
And they're just wasting money and causing more angst. So. Yeah.
But speaking of angst and control, the thing that scares us is none of us wants to have a painful death, right? So many of us don't want to die, and death itself scares us. But for those of us, regardless of whether you're scared of dying and not existing anymore, the actual death process of dying itself is awfully scary.
Mm. Absolutely.
And you and your job see patients dying all the time.
Mm.
Mm. What... Are they always in discomfort when they die? Yeah.
It's one of the most frequent things I'm asked and one of the biggest terrors people have. They say, you know, a lot of patients say, look, okay, I've got cancer. I know my time is short. I just don't want to be in pain when I die. And we are very, very good. And I mean, largely palliative care doctors are very, very good at caring for someone at the end of their life. Not just managing pain, but there's all sorts of other symptoms people can get, like nausea, shortness of breath, fatigue. We have excellent medications for all of these things. So I know very few people where we were unable to get on top of their pain and they didn't die as well as one would have hoped. But the vast, vast, vast majority of patients are able to go to sleep, I guess, or be drowsy, or generally they're unwell for some other reason, and they're unaware that they're dying, or unaware at the time of death, or they're not in pain. It is definitely achievable. It's a fear that a lot of people have, understandably. I have that fear as well. But having seen it every day and having seen successful deaths, so to speak, it's very morbid, it is definitely achievable. And I think it's interesting now, especially in the context that we're in right now, where voluntary assisted dying has come into play in Melbourne. It's now legal for someone to...
It has become. The bill has been passed and it has become a...
As of a couple of weeks ago, yeah.
Wow.
And in fact, the first woman has already gone through that process and she died.
Oh, yes, I heard that the other day. She was surrounded by her daughter and they were playing her favourite music.
Exactly, exactly. She was a woman from Bendigo, I believe. And, you know, that was a classic example of a good death.
Right.
And as morbid as this topic is, and I'm sure some people might be tuning out, but this is what it comes back to, what we were saying right at the start, where death is, you know, the only thing that's guaranteed. And the more we talk about it, the more acceptable it is as a topic at a table, the less the fear there will be around the concept. You know, we talk about, you know, when someone has a baby, when someone has a birthday, when someone has this, we always focus on the good things, but we need to think of death in a way as a good thing, and the ability to be able to plan, hopefully, and know what's going to happen and what you want at that point in time, that should also be something that we're more comfortable to talk about. So a lot of this fear will go away.
So beautiful how you said a successful death. I think that everyone wants that. That's such a lovely way to say that. I was successfully died.
I know, it sounds crazy, but you know, we all want to die with dignity. We don't want to drag on. We don't want to make our loved ones miserable. We don't want them to have to care for us for months and months on end, or after we die have to deal with the aftermath in terms of not just the funeral but our finances and our will and our this and our that. It's almost a responsibility of ours that we should be planning all of this. I know it sounds ridiculous, especially
no, it's important. I mean, death is another it's a checkpoint or a milestone in life. That's when your life ends. As you said, it's inevitable. So why are we so scared of it? Death is not like cancer where you don't know if you'll get it or not. 100% of us will die.
Exactly. So. Exactly right. Whatever it is, whether it's cancer, some other cause of being hit by a bus, it could happen at any point.
Yeah.
And it's about being as planned or talking about as much as you can. And it comes down to, you know, all the other issues that surround it, things like organ donation or all those things. No one likes to talk about it. Even I find it difficult to bring up that subject with my own family. But no one likes to talk about it. That's never going to happen to you. You're not going to be in that situation. Why are we talking about it? Be happy, you know. But just a quick conversation can go such a long way.
I think talking about disease and death in not in a scared way, but in this could happen to us, so let's be prepared way, will save a lot of heartache and trouble for everyone, right? So tell me one thing. So after you became a doctor and you started seeing people dying, did that reduce your personal fear of death? Like now you see that person, multiple people going from being alive 1 minute and dead.
I think it has reduced my personal fear. To be honest with you, I had never really thought about it at all. Like I'm sure a lot of people hadn't thought of my own death. I still don't think about it, but hadn't thought about it before. And now that I see it on an almost daily basis, I have confidence and comfort in knowing that I will be taken care of. But at the same time, and this will sound very cliche, it's really, really made me appreciate every day because we really don't know what's going to happen to us tomorrow. So living in the moment, as we say, it's really opened my eyes about that. So.
I can imagine, yeah, that does sound like a cliche, but when it comes from somebody who has seen death every day and who often tries to tell people the inevitable, you know, the fact that they're dying. You have to deliver this news often. You see it often. You comfort people often. So, and you see often when you're trying to treat somebody, but sometimes it can go wrong or they can get worse or they don't respond. And you know that you've done everything and people still die. So that thing that anything could change at any minute, our circumstances could change to try and live the best life that you have. So important, right?
Absolutely.
And that life isn't desperately trying to avoid cancer. That life is trying to overall, as a human being, trying to improve your life and your quality of your life and your body.
Exactly. Doing and whatever it is important to you, whatever values you have, whether it's being with family, friends, going traveling, whatever it is, doing that and not procrastinating and leaving it till later because you never know. But also, you know, I will say the majority of patients that I see or treat are very good when it comes to talking about death, and that's generally because they've been battling their cancer for years or months. So they themselves have thought about their own death. It's often the family who struggle. And that's, as a doctor, one of the hardest things we have to do is talk to family members, because they are often in denial or not accepting, yeah. or it's their coping mechanism and they don't want to talk yeah. about it. Whereas if they actually turn to their loved one and say, hey, you know, mom, have you thought about this? Often
yeah.
the person's like, well, actually I have, you just haven't listened to me,
yeah.
you know?
So, do you have any story of a successful way in which you saw a patient of yours communicate to their family their cancer diagnosis and the family and the whole family managed it well?
I think often what happens, and we encourage this, is that if we're about to... So I will say often when I see a patient, they already know they have cancer.
Okay.
Because I'm an oncologist, you know, no one goes to an oncologist, or no one should go to an oncologist not knowing they have cancer, you right. know, because it's kind of in my title. So
yeah.
So I'm not frequently the person who breaks news
okay.
like that, but I am very frequently, if not daily, the person to talk about treatment options and to tell someone that, yes, they have cancer and they're incurable.
Okay.
And we often tell people to bring in a family member at that point.
Mm.
It's so important. Family or a friend, someone, you know, to the point where we really hesitate to break such news if someone's by themselves. And we will go out of our way to get someone on the phone or tell someone, come back next week with your mum, you know.
Yeah.
We really go to a lot of effort because it makes a huge difference. There's a whole lot of reasons for that. Obviously, having a support person there is incredibly important to the patient. You know, they've got someone there. But often there's other elements. They're so emotional at that point, they might only absorb 10% of what they say. And yeah. then they'll go home and think, oh God, what did the doctor tell me again? Yeah. What are my treatment options? So having someone else there someone else who's heard that information is very important. I see it in the sense that family being present is a huge thing.
Okay.
I've also seen it go the other way where it's not very good. And often this is it can often be a cultural thing mm-hmm. as well. There are many cultures. I think Indian for us is one. I think I've seen a lot of Greek families as well where saying the word cancer or saying the word death is a big no-no.
Okay.
And many family members say, don't tell mum
mm.
that she's got cancer. Don't tell her.
But is that puts you in a tough position,
really,
right?
Really, absolutely. Because their very strong belief is that if you tell her, she's going to lose all hope and she will die quicker.
Mm.
And they absolutely genuinely believe this, which, you know, biologically doesn't make a lot of sense. Yeah. But maybe, you know...
Yeah.
Emotionally,
but then what are your legal obligations? You have to tell the patient.
Well, legally, we don't have to tell the patient, but legally we have to say to the patient, do you want to know?
Okay.
So often, vast majority of time in this situation, the patient says, yeah, why am I seeing you? Why am I in an oncology unit? Why are you all crying? Because yeah. they can see, you know, and this is often if there's a language barrier, for example, yeah. why are you crying? What's wrong with me? I want to know everything. Yeah. How long do I have to live? What are my options? And absolutely in that situation, legally we tell them we have to. They're our patient at the end of the day. Having said that, there are some cases where the patient says, don't tell me, I don't want to know, tell everything to my daughter and she will deal with it and I'm happy with whatever decision she makes. That's still incredibly difficult for us because we're not fundamentally treating the daughter, we're treating the patient.
Mm.
So how do you have a discussion about cancer, death, dying, prognosis, treatment when they don't want to know anything about it? And yeah. that's almost impossible. So most patients in that situation, we gloss over the more dangerous things, or not dangerous, the gloss over the more difficult things,
mm-hmm.
like talking about prognosis, mm-hmm. and we'll just focus on treatment. But they are definitely the harder patients to treat, yeah.
You know, I'm feeling a lot more comforted about death after talking to you. This is going to be a very emotional thing, but, and I hate to put you on the spot like that, but I just feel like saying it, you'll be there for me, friend, won't you?
Aww.
If I'm dying.
Of course I will be.
And I'll be there for you.
Thank you.
And we'll be there for each other's families.
Absolutely.
But it's so comforting to me to hear from a doctor about death so frankly.
Mm.
And yeah, and now I know. For example, my sister has been on my case to get a pap smear.
Mm.
And I'm an educated person. But I've been putting it off thinking, I'll eventually get to it. I mean, I'm not really in that.
Mm.
But I'm going to make it a priority and go and get a pap smear and
good.
Talk about disease and death in a more constructive and useful way with my family.
Yeah, exactly. That's very well said, I think. There's so much emotion around it.
Yeah.
It just clouds the picture and it makes it into a far more traumatic experience than it has to be.
True.
You should just be, as much as you can, approach with a logical, reasonable, rational, you know, way of mind. This is how it is. This might happen to me. This is what I want. This is what I don't want. What do you want? Done. And you never have to talk about it again, ever. Yeah. You know, it's just a conversation that has to be had once.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And also it's so comforting to me to hear that if me or my loved ones got a cancer diagnosis, there's a chance that it could be too late. But there's a great chance, if we catch it on time, that it could be something that they can manage well in their lives.
Absolutely.
And even if they did have to succumb to the cancer, that the palliative aspect of it is something that expert doctors like yourself manage every day so that it's not a horrible, painful,
absolutely,
you know, wow,
absolutely.
This is making me feel really comforted right now. Yeah, and I hope that for all of my friends whose families are suffering from, you know, somebody in the family has cancer, I hope that they are all afforded this good care, palliative care or treatment for managing it.
Absolutely. I think if anyone's listening in that boat and they're not happy with the care they're receiving, they should go to another person.
Go to another doctor.
Yeah. Because sometimes it's not the right fit for you.
Yeah.
Just go to someone else.
Yeah, if your gut is telling you, right, that this isn't working out, don't just say, oh, no, it's just me.
Mm.
Like, you have the option. You have the right to go to someone else.
Absolutely. Another benefit of being in Australia, you know, you can just go to another hospital, another doctor, whatever it is, ask for a second opinion, do it. Yeah.
Wow. I wanted to end with something. You've just come back from a very fancy, world-famous cancer conference in Chicago.
Oh, yes.
What's it called again?
So the conference is it's called American Society of Clinical Oncology, or ASCO. That's the big association in America. And every year they have a conference, an annual scientific meeting in Chicago. And it's every first week of June every year.
It was huge. Like, I was looking at your Instagram stories. There were public billboards announcing it around Chicago, and like the whole city knew that this cancer conference is happening there.
Yeah, it's one of the most incredible things I've seen. It was the first year I've been.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of my seniors say, oh yeah, we go every year, it's no big deal. But to me, it was absolutely mind-blowing. It was about 40,000 attendees.
Wow. From all over the world.
All over the world. Doctors, nurses, allied health, patients, you know, pharma companies, everyone. All and every year, essentially, they present any new or groundbreaking trials, clinical work that could have happened anywhere, or even significant negative trials where something hasn't proven to be beneficial. Mm-hmm. That's equally important.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lectures, there's seminars, there's, you know, it's just absolutely amazing. Yeah.
What was one of the most exciting things you learned or discovered or saw?
I think It's a bit of a technical answer,
okay. But
my personal interest is in melanoma or skin cancer. And one of the some very early research has shown that if someone is diagnosed with melanoma, classically what happens is you do surgery, you remove it, and then you might have treatment afterwards, like immunotherapy, which is medication through a drip. You might have that to mop up any melanoma cells that are still floating around after surgery. What we're now trying to do is reverse that. So we give the immunotherapy first to shrink down the melanoma. And then if there's any melanoma left, we operate on it at that point. And so they presented this data at Chicago this year where the immunotherapy or the treatment's given first and then they have surgery. And some of the results are fantastic. Very early data, but it showed that patients who have the treatment first and then they go to surgery, when they remove the melanoma specimen, all the cancer cells in that melanoma specimen might be completely gone, you know, might be completely dead or dormant.
So it's just like a scab that's in
there.
Yeah,
exactly. And it's all been switched off by the treatment before surgery. And then those patients who then have that surgery, none of those patients have had their melanoma come back after surgery, which is amazing. So they're cured. And again, this word that we, you know, haven't really been using before, we're now using. So things like that, I think, are genuinely get me excited, you know.
When you go to these conferences and you learn these new ideas, do you have the power to come back and implement that in your
eventually we do, definitely not overnight, because this data, you know, it's a few hundred patients, it's early,
right?
But it's only a matter of months or years where we start implementing that, which is very short on the scale of human lifespan.
Yes.
So,
And very quick on the scale of new medical developments. Like months is like huge compared to before when it was years away.
Exactly.
Now
exactly
months away is a new treatment or a new modality or a new approach or whatever.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we're seeing this far more in oncology than probably any other discipline in medicine, which is amazing. You know, when was the last time we discovered a new antibiotic? When was the last time we had a new cholesterol medication? It's been decades. Mm. Whereas things literally change overnight for us in our field, which is so exciting, but obviously fundamentally great for our patients. Yeah. So
melanoma, melanoma is your particular interest. So tell me, everyone needs to wear sunscreen if they're going to be in the daylight anytime.
A sunscreen? Yeah. Yeah. Well, the classic phrase is 10 to 3, stay under a tree or something like that. So that's when we know that UV index is highest.
Okay.
So, and people who've traveled overseas will know, but the sun in Australia is very different to the sun overseas. Mm. In our summer months here, you know, you can be out for 5 or 10 minutes and feel a really burning sensation in your skin. Mm. Even when I'm driving in the car and I've got sun, you know, through the window, I can still feel that burn on my skin. Whereas if you're in America or other countries and you're outside for a few hours in summer, you don't feel that burn. Mm. And that's because our UV is so bad here.
We don't have an ozone layer. We have an ozone hole so that the UV comes through unfiltered.
Exactly. Right. So wearing sunscreen, wearing a hat, wearing sunglasses as well, and good sunglasses, not just the fashionable ones, but the ones that are actually polarized and keeping UV out, most important things.
So even if you're Indian, you wear sunscreen, right? Because a lot of Indian people are like dark-skinned.
Yeah, exactly. Look, to be honest with you, fortunately, Indians and Asians have a much less risk of getting melanoma from UV.
Okay.
So I would still argue that it's important because even though we're Indian, we're living a Western lifestyle, so we're still exposed to all the Western you know, risk factors, whether it's UV or not. Indians in particular are at risk of getting melanoma on the soles of their feet or palms of their hands. So it's a different type of melanoma. Okay. So we certainly can still get it. So definitely sunscreen, slip, swap, slaps. All those things you learn in primary school.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Prachi Bhave, for coming on my podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It was phenomenal to have this beautiful medical knowledge presented in such an accessible way.
Thank you. It was very fun.
You're the best and the funniest doctor.
Oh, thanks. How many do you know?
Okay, thank you, Prachi. And I hope that I'll have you back in the future to discuss something new about cancer.
Definitely. Absolutely.
Bye.
Bye. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey.